And then you
Exactly, like that.
And then that will be recorded to your computer, and then there's some few directions for how to upload that for where other people can edit it and post it to the website for other people to listen to. So please, again, email info@brightwaysend.org about that, or talk to sync our current videographers, or Tyler, raise your hand. John, are you a videographer sometimes? Yeah. Keegan, we're trying to get him. He's been doing it since he came to Bright Ways End. We're trying to get him to do something else. So yeah, please let us know if you're willing to do that. Okay, now we really are beginning. So now the editors will have to cut that section out, but all right, so here we are. This is the sixth 10 Fields of Zen class, or maybe it's the seventh, but anyway, this is field six, opening your heart, self-acceptance and non-separation. So if you were here earlier, you know that we did chanted the Metta Sutta instead of our one of our regular Tuesday chants. So Buddhism may not often seem very warm and fuzzy. I've heard people say, kind of, where is the love? You know, we have the Buddha's story where, you know, he was dissatisfied with life and he left everything. He left his family behind. He left his wife and young child, you know, according to the stories, behind to seek his spiritual awakening, renounced everything. Buddhist monastics were taught to like meditate on corpses so they wouldn't be attached to life, on the to their bodies. We're definitely, you know, this not depending on relationships, not depending on like worldly relationships for happiness. There's definitely been lots of hardcore practices in monasticism, you know, emphasis on things like the emptiness of self and all things. So undoubtedly at times Buddhism and Zen have been, can be a little austere, self-focused, skeptical of the happiness that we get from human relationships, and especially where contrasted with other religions, where like love of God is constantly emphasized, or where family relationships are not only like given a high priority, but like are explicitly part of the religious path and practice, right? You know, being a good husband or wife or parent, and there's many religions where your function in society or in the community is of great importance. So in Buddhism, sometimes you have to look a little carefully for the heart-centered stuff. But here's where you can find it. This is not an exhaustive list by any means. So the first is really in the Buddha's person. So not just like the teachings that we, you know, were remembered and then eventually written down and passed down, which can sound very kind of pragmatic, maybe even clinical. But the Buddha's person, which is described in these old scriptures, is he was like just infinitely kind and patient. After his awakening, when he didn't even really want to teach, but once he finally did teach, he taught for another 50 years, and they say he was never alone for a moment. Like, so he had just countless followers and people around who were just constantly asking for the Dharma and who knows what else, you know. They like probably got into conflicts and had issues and, hey, Buddha, you know, like, so he was open to all of that, He didn't turn anyone away who wanted to learn about the Dharma. He was patient and compassionate and wise. He could tell what people needed. Accepted everyone. So in a way, like, he was embodying and enacting a very important aspect of this practice, even though there's, you know, may not be so much in the core teachings about the importance of this, although there is, which we chanted tonight. The heart aspect of our practice is also present in Sangha. We have three treasures: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And Sangha is one of the three treasures. So it's acknowledged that we can't do this alone. Famously, the Buddha told Ananda that admirable friendship is not half of the holy life, which is what Ananda said. It's the whole of the holy life. Admirable friendship is the whole of the holy life. We have the Brahma Viharas, which I will be getting into later. We'll do a meditation. So that's metta and our goodwill, karuna or compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, and upeka, equanimity. And these are understood to be prerequisites for spiritual practice. Then we have the beautiful Metta Sutra, which, you know, just the most, there's lots of moving lines in it, but my favorite, I think it's even as a mother protects with her life, her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. And then just, we'll talk about it a lot, but in Zen, we have our own forms of heart practice. Again, it's not in Buddhism and Zen, it doesn't tend to be kind of a ecstatic kind of, you know, really emotional thing. Tends to be a little more subdued and staid, but Sangha continues to be very important in Chan and Zen practice. We also in Chan and Zen really came to emphasize the importance of the teacher-student relationship. So where you are really allowing yourself to be known by a teacher, really bringing everything forward, allowing them to see where your obstacles are, and then really kind of through that interaction, and then confirmed by that interaction, is your own awakening. We also have ceremonies, lots of ceremonies, which can really touch the heart if we allow them to. I've felt my heart pretty opened by Dharma study at times. Depending on the Dharma study, reading some Dogen, something just feels very opening and inspiring. Just briefly, anyone who's been practicing for a while, have anything else or you know, something you can say about how Dharma practice has required you to open your heart and or has led you to open your heart? Leah. And then Nick.
So I feel very moved by the Universal Gateway of Compassion.
Mm.
And I consider Kanzan to be like my patron saint, not to mix, you know, religions, but I'm doing it. I'm doing it right now. But I just, it moves me and I make this gesture. It's like, mm-hmm. And I imagine her personified, like sitting next to me often. So
thank you. Mick, and then John, and then Shoketsu.
I would say for me it's particularly retreat. I think there's something just sort of so profound about just being in the same space, doing the same thing with people for that period of time. Your heart just sort of runs out of options and just kind of opens up. And I don't know, it's just something about, like, I think particularly our retreats, because we build the space together and then we take down the space together. It's just something that we all, like, literally just build together, and that's just so sweet for me.
John.
Yeah, I would say that unconditional love is sort of a non-dual source of all precepts. When you get right down to it. And also Zazen and Sesshin is incredibly heart-opening. And, you know, the oneness of Zen. So all of that sort of screams love, I guess.
Shoketsu.
Yeah, I would say Kanzeon is the reason I came to Zen Buddhism. Quite frankly, I was looking for compassion, even back when I lived in Boston. So anyway, so Kanzeon is a wonderful patron saint, if you would say. And also, I would agree that Sesshin is wonderful, spending that much time being with others. I have a long list. And the other thing would be Metasutra. I used to do that once a week with a group. Not doing it so much anymore, but that's an opener. And I have something else, but you get the idea. Oh, I was going to say, being so Shuso way, way back, being the first one to sort of take care of the Sangha, look after the Sangha for Domyo or with Domyo. Those are all heart opening.
So we got it. We got it. It does, you know, you're not going to walk in and have us just, you know, be singing love from the rafters, right? But it definitely is part of our practice. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about kind of how it manifests, particularly in Zen. But I figured we'd do a little Brahma Vihara meditation. And as we do it, like, it really is, you know, a little as like John had mentioned, that this open-heartedness is the basis for the precepts. You know, like the precepts describe enlightened action. And there really is, like, we could almost imagine that we have to kind of become enlightened or, you know, awaken to reality and whatever, and then, you know, our heart will open. But really, like, a closed heart kind of prevents awakening, and a closed heart not just to others but to ourselves. So there's an incredibly critical piece here also about profound self-acceptance. So really, the Brahma Vihara meditations, whether, you know, some people do this as a regular practice. We have a group that meets in the cloud on Sundays before the regular services to do this every Sunday. So some people, you know, make it part of their personal practices, and some of us, you know, don't do it explicitly, right? We're not, we don't like, oh, I did 10 minutes of metta meditation. And yet this, it's kind of like, it conveys clearly what the direction is, right? The direction that we want to be going in our life, in our daily life, in all of our relationships. So when we do the Brahma Vihara meditations, it's usually just reframed as metta meditation, but I'm going to kind of bring in some of the others as well. We try to summon a feeling, calling to mind someone and summoning a feeling. It should be a felt sense. And we kind of, you know, just get familiar with that felt sense, just really get it in our bodies. And then we deliberately shift our mind to another being or another scenario. And try, see if we can kind of hold that feeling as we shift the subject of our attention. And usually, is a kind of set up to deliberately like challenge our ability to hold that same feeling. And that is just instructive. It's not a matter of like failure. It's simply a matter of within our own hearts, you know, we're feeling metta or goodwill for a being for whom it's very easy. And then we try to extend it towards somebody who's more difficult and we feel our hearts kind of closing down a little bit. We just take note of that and we try to lean into opening it up some more. And it takes time. It's not where we don't expect instant results. The idea is to just gradually expand and become a little more, have a little more facility with this openness. So, and also it's extremely important, I think just basically, but it was definitely very important to me to clarify how extending goodwill or compassion toward someone who is causing harm is not about capitulation. Just like loving your enemy is not capitulation. Just, I feel like we should all just kind of memorize that little phrase, loving your enemy is not capitulation. And that balances both ways, right? It's like, don't capitulate thinking that's love, but also when you love, you know, reckon, don't capitulate if that's, you know, yeah, go ahead and love. But if you think there's something you need to stand up for or hold a boundary or whatever, that is entirely compatible. So yes, with that. So let's, if you want to close your eyes, you can. Call to mind a being for whom it is just second nature for you to feel unconditional goodwill toward. Just easy, comes very naturally. Be a probably like a child, or for many of us, it is a pet. No shame in starting with a pet. The point is that we access this, just this unconditional goodwill. Just may you be happy. May you truly be happy. So just visualize that being. Visualize them being happy. May you be truly happy. So even filtering out any sense of, you know, judgment about kinds of happiness, but truly happy, truly, truly want this person, this being, to be happy. A sense of openness. Openness in the heart. Sense of permeability. Things can flow into us and flow out. Now imagine that being, or a similar being, picture them happy. They are just delighted, doing something, experiencing something, just so delighted. As we watch beings for whom we feel goodwill experience happiness, that is sympathetic joy. Now call to mind someone you know who is suffering. Feel their suffering, and because of your goodwill, you want their suffering to end. May you be at ease. May you be free from fear and anxiety. Picturing them becoming free from their suffering. There's that generosity of spirit. We're not thinking about whether they deserve it or we can provide it or anything. We just wish for it to be so. And that is compassion. Now imagine that you have lived a long and happy life. You lived 100 years. You passed away. 100 years have passed, and you are observing from some vantage point. It's humankind continuing on its way. All the people you knew and loved are gone. You watch people go about their lives, finding their fortunes. Falling in love. Conflicting, fulfilling their dreams. Building cities. Governments rising and falling. From your perspective, you can view all of this drama With some measure of equanimity. Simply because of your perspective. And because none of it involves you directly. Then, if we can get familiar with that sense of equanimity, maybe we access it not through a meditation, but through a walk in nature, something like that. Can we bring that sense of equanimity back into relationship? And we even just call to mind people who are in our lives and have that same sense of equanimity about them and the path that they are on. This doesn't make us in any way cold toward them. It just makes us more stable. More stable and able to be a peaceful presence for them. So that is all for Brahma Viharas. I know that there are some people in the Sangha who make this a practice. So I don't know if I want to invite anyone who does to say something about how it has been useful, transformative. Coral.
Okay, so I really like the meditation where you've passed away and you're looking into the future. I even do like this meditation where I've passed away and it's actually right now. And the people who I know and everything are still alive. But it makes me think of that Uchiyama Roshi says, like meditating from your coffin. I really like that. And I've done it at retreats and stuff. And the thing that comes up for me is this release of all this responsibility that I told myself that I was responsible for. Because when I really look at the world from this place where I had, like, if I'm just looking at it from a place where I have no connection to this, it just goes on. People are okay. It doesn't matter. But in a really like positive and releasing way that I get to take care of myself, and I am worthy of, you know, spending my time the way that is good for me. And it comes from like a practice of like, I'm worthy, you know, I don't need to like constantly be doing these things to prove that I'm like worthy of love and existing and everything like that. So that's kind of where that has led for me. Yeah. Thank you.
John.
It's a very profound practice. And if anybody can't fully accept themselves and totally love themselves or understand how you can love everybody, I highly recommend it. And it makes Zazen better. It makes dealing with life better. You basically build a ground of unconditional love that you respond out of. It helps all your responses to everything. So I highly recommend it.
And it does bring me to, so traditionally, you know, this practice goes back, I don't know, a couple thousand years. They told us to begin with ourselves. Like to that easy person that we have to think of a puppy, like I said, think of yourself, which is so like, I don't actually know anyone for whom that would just be like, oh yeah, cool. Right. I mean, if you do that practice and you really do, you know, call yourself to mind, may you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at ease. May you be happy. Just amazing how many like conditions the mind comes up with, kind of like, yeah, but you know, maybe once you do that, maybe once you, I don't know, like, because we're, you know, self-critical and insecure and whatever, that just unconditional, you know, compassion for ourselves, goodwill for ourselves. It's always like only once we meet these certain standards or criteria. And really it's true until we completely are able to completely do that meta for ourselves, to completely accept ourselves, not just a Pollyanna kind of like, I'm good enough. But really that acceptance, I mean, our spiritual practice it's an obstruction in our spiritual practice and in our ability to feel that for others. The classic story in Buddhism that illustrates this, which many of you know, is from the Lotus Sutra, and it's the story of the lost son. So a young man, who knows why, but he sets off from home. He doesn't want to be at home anymore. So he sets off wandering. He wanders and wanders for who knows, maybe a couple decades. And his father misses him greatly. This is his only son. And the father becomes quite well-to-do. And he longs not just for the son, but for an heir. And the son ends up wandering back home, but he's so, I kind of like to embellish it, right? Kind of think like he's just so out of it. He's just strung out. He doesn't even recognize who he is or where he is. So he doesn't recognize his father or that he's home. But his father's so happy to see him that he sends some of his men out to, like, you know, bring the son home. But the son just thinks that he's being arrested or something, so he just runs away in fear. So the father just gradually, so he sends, he like through other people, he hires the son to do just totally the most menial tasks, just, you know, mucking out the stables. And the son's able to like, okay, you know, kind of settles down. He's able to just muck out the stables. And over years, the father just, you know, empowers him a little more. Eventually the father kind of comes and gets to know him and promotes him. And pretty soon the son is like his main helper. And then eventually, finally, he says, you know, publicly says, this is my heir. But the son at that point has come to the point where he can accept that. So this is a parable told by the Buddha to explain like our Buddha nature and how we can't accept it. That even though we have this perfect nature, we just, and there's nothing preventing us from whatever, accessing it, appreciating it, of receiving our inheritance, right? There's nothing preventing us from receiving our inheritance except our own idea of ourselves. So that is part of what we get to work on in Zen. Self-acceptance. And then there's also the aspect of real relationships. So I think of this as kind of where the rubber meets the road. And if you imagine that monks, off in their monasteries, right? just getting to sit meditation all the time, and you know, they don't have to have real jobs, and they don't have to have in-laws and whatever, you know, and what once upon a time they didn't have any kids or anything. And you think like, well, isn't that great? They would just be managed to escape from all of this relationship stuff. But they didn't, right? There's still people there, and they're probably just even more intense. You can't get away from it. So real relationships with real people, right? I mean, in some senses, like this whole like meta practice stuff, it's lovely, but you know, you could just be sitting around just thinking about compassion and goodwill, and then, you know, not manifesting that in real relationships. And, you know, it's very humbling. Teacher I knew once said, relationships bring out the worst in us. And from a Zen point of view, that is a good thing. I mean, it's a frustrating thing, but I said it's easy to be enlightened on a mountaintop. Right? With nobody around. Oh, yes. Oh, just, you know, deep in my meditation. I see how everything is one. And then you just, you know, not only descend into the marketplace where you have to deal with people, but like you have to go deal with your family, right? People who are just not impressed with who you are, right? And they don't want to hear about that. So real relationships. They teach us about ourselves. They teach us about, you know, our karma. They give us an opportunity. And, you know, to the meta practice type of thing is not like completely separate from this, of course, right? There's, if you have someone in your life, particularly you have a personal relationship with, and they are difficult, if you can keep working on it, and if you can find a way to at least momentarily like send them unconditional metta, that usually has a major effect, really changes your relationship to that person and decreases the reactivity and increases the compassion. And there are challenges in Sangha. So we have challenges in our families, challenges with friends, challenges with people in our community. And then inevitably, we will also have challenges in Sangha. We're all human beings. We're in relationship to each other. And actually, as a Sangha grows and matures, you're around longer, you get to know people more, you get more involved, we do more things together, we do retreats, you know, maybe we buy a building, we, you know, we do programs, you get do roles like Shuso. It's going to bring us all in contact and relationship in new and different ways, many of which can end up being challenging. I mean, some people aren't challenging, right, for you, but some people are. And it seems pretty inevitable. It's like our karma, if you want to say, like our who we are in terms of our conditioning and our personality and everything, whatever, however we've ended up, is sometimes it just doesn't mix with somebody else's karma very well. Now, you know, it's because there's something wrong with them. But when you really think about it, you know, you have to admit, okay, well, right, our karma just doesn't mix. But that is such an amazing and wonderful and awful opportunity. I mean, many of you will have heard me talk about this before, but like, you know, just to tell on myself, there were at least a couple people in the Dharmarin Sangha that I just thought, I mean, here's the thing. It's like when you realize it's not just about your personal preference, but like this person is actually doing harm to the Sangha. They're actually like not good for them to be around here. And then, you know, you go to the teacher and say, I got to tell you what this person is like. And then when the teacher's just like, oh, okay. It's like, because unless someone really does an ethical violation, they don't get kicked out of the Sangha. Like it is really, it should be really, really hard to kick somebody out of a Sangha. I mean, the story goes that the Buddha, you know, included everyone, including ex-murderers and everything. And then they say he was kind of on his deathbed toward the end of his life. And he said, okay, there's this one guy you should kick out of the Sangha. Probably because he was just like so disruptive that if the Buddha wasn't around, he would just cause too much damage, right? But there's one guy, you know, out of who knows, thousands of followers, if this one guy you should probably kick out. So the chances are that whoever it is that we do not meet well with is not going away. And hopefully we don't go away either. And hopefully we don't just avoid them. Although, I mean, that there's some merit in trying to kind of avoid them a little bit. I am grateful for having had the opportunity to work through much of my stuff. And, you know, my classic story is one with my Dharma brother, who's now abbot of Dharmarin. And I don't know, he and I nothing wrong with either of us, right? It's not like either of us was mean or abusive or anything. But just, we just did not. I mean, we did like each other, and we didn't, and we hated each other. Right? It was just, and Gyokuko, she was both of our teachers, and she just assigned us like stuff in totally different areas so that we didn't like bug each other. And yet we still were having like meals together every day. We still like, you know, you still see each other. And, what I noticed was, because, so this is where we say, do your own practice. And it can sound kind of, I don't know, it can sound kind of cold. And sometimes it's not a wise thing. Sometimes something needs to be said, right? Like we have to ask somebody to moderate their behavior, act more respectfully, communicate differently, something like that, right? So this can be taken to an extreme, which just allows dysfunction in a group. So saying that, there is great merit in this idea of doing your own practice so that when you come up against someone, you don't, I mean, other than just asking for basic respectful treatment, you don't then think like, well, how can I work on this? We usually wouldn't mean work on this relationship, right? We're meaning, how do I get this person to act differently? How do I get them to understand my perspective? And instead, we're just saying, I'm just going to look at my own reactions and responses, try to understand, why does this person bother me so much? What is going on here? What piece is mine? What piece might I be able to let go of? And what I saw was that eventually, as I was able to admit it to myself, is that when I respect someone, I want their approval. You know, I wanted my father's approval, and so I do all the things. So I want the approval. And then I look over there and I go, you know, and His karma was completely different. He had some trauma. He had a difficulty in trusting. And so as soon as I leaned toward him for like, hey, you want to give me some? He was like, stay away from me. Like, so, and then I would feel more insecure. Yeah. And then I would lean in more. And then he'd be like, like, so our karmic patterns were just a total mismatch. So at some point I recognized like, okay, you know, I would say things, I would do things, and I could see, even though he has like inscrutable face and he looks just like he was just like an enlightened Buddha from the beginning, I could tell when I, you know, it's just this faintest little thing I could see him just go like, oh, a judgment. And I could see that, and then I would react. And at a certain point, I was like, you know, I can't read your mind. So if you want me to do something different, you can tell me. I'm going to stop guessing and just be who I am and say what I say and whatever. And, you know, kind of like put the responsibility back on him. And then in addition, I realized like, why do I want that affirmation that, am I okay? Was that okay? I was like, well, I want to know that he loves me. And then I'm like, I think he probably does. So why don't I just act like that's true? Why don't I just like, instead of making him prove it, why do I just like take it on faith and act like it's true? So I just dropped all that extra conniving, and that let him relax, because, I mean, I don't know, he never really told me how it all unfolded from his perspective, but he seemed to relax and step forward because like he did love me and he did care about me. As long as I wasn't trying to like manipulate him, you know, he was perfectly friendly. So then we started to work together great and really respect each other. And, you know, I learned a lot about myself and was able, I mean, not that we can ever guarantee that when we shift that the other person's going to shift. We don't know that. But the very least, I shifted a lot of my angst around it, right? So I just encourage you, I mean, if and when, if you stick around long enough and you find somebody in the Sangha that your karma doesn't mix with, I hope you don't leave. I mean, I don't want you to leave. I don't want anybody to leave. I want you to stick it out and realize this is part of the richness of that, you know, relationships teaching us, opening the heart. So I have there's a few minutes left. Any last comments or questions? Ruthann?
Oh, thank you, Delmio, for this. And also, thank you because, you know, I just used my phone. And like when Anju announced, you know, Sazen was finished, I could hear him and I could hear the Dharma talk clearly. But like Sunday morning, I didn't even stay with a financial meeting because the audio was so faint and I didn't know if it was my phone. And any rate, so it's good. And I'm non-techie, but I wanted to say in the metta, the first step in this practice, with the loved one, I think in perhaps their last hours of this life or whatever their difficulties are in their last day or days, I just at ease, I just wish that so strongly. And that's so easy to do for anybody you love, no matter what, for me, no matter what personality differences you have. I mean, whatever grip this material world has on any of us. And I know, I got this book that's been written, oh, decades ago. Rosenberg's Marshall was a non-conflict person. And it's sometimes when we have a need that we feel isn't being met, no matter how basic it is, a person's behavior can trigger that in us. And they may have no idea they're doing that for us. So once I said about a neighbor here, oh yeah, she makes me feel unsafe. And then I could say, okay, I can sit with that. I can see why. And so, I mean, we all have these basic kind of structure blocks. They're not bad. They're not good. But, you know, we have these practices because they work. And thank you so much for this Dharma talk and this evening practice.
Thank you, Ruthann. That's a brilliant suggestion. Like, there's somebody you kind of should feel goodwill toward, but you're a little like kind of imagining, what if this was, you know, only had a couple days to live? It would just be like, never mind about all that stuff, you know. Did you have something, Courtney? No? Okay. All right. Well, we dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth.
All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored moons, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thanks for being here.
Sweet dreams.